Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live, hour two of an Ask Me Anything show here on a Friday evening with you. The number to call if you want your question on the air is 888-318-7884. 888-31-TRUTH is the number to call. And as you know, if you heard the first hour, the guest today is our own senior apologist, author, speaker, podcaster, debater, weird questions answerer, enjoyer. It's Jimmy Akin, and Jimmy is back, ready to take more questions from you for this hour. My name is Thomas Graff. I'm filling in for Cy Kellett today, as he just takes a normal afternoon off, needs to unwind a little bit, blow off some steam, and I'm filling in for him in the host's chair until he returns on Monday. So, Jimmy, if you are ready, we will dive back into the questions that our callers have.
Oh, no problem, man. It's. I guess we want to be a little careful in what we reveal about Cy when he's not here, like the fact that he runs on steam power, you know?
Right, right.
I'm yeah. Sorry.
I may have let slip that he's a bit of a steampunk, what's the word for someone who's half robot, half human? Cyborg? Is that the
cyborg,
thing?
Cyborg, yeah.
Yeah, Cy is a steampunk cyborg. I apologize
and,
to Cy.
And he would acknowledge the punk part, definitely. I'm just not sure he would acknowledge the steam part publicly.
Right, right. So I apologize to Cy for revealing that intimate detail of his private life. I'm sure I'll take a tongue lashing from him on Monday. If I can just withstand the steam, I think I'll be okay. But meanwhile, as we await Cy's wrathful return, we're going to go to Randall to kick off the hour. Randall calling from California. Randall, you are on the air with Jimmy Akin. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, how's it going? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. Thank you. Hey, Jimmy. So my question is about the sacrament of holy orders. Specifically, so do priests receive the sacrament of holy orders once or multiple times? Like, does that mean if, you know, a certain priest, like Pope Francis, did he receive a third of the sacrament three times, deacon, priest, bishop, or is it more like a one-time thing? And one other confusion I have is, are there different versions of holy orders for each rank, and wouldn't that make it three different sacraments instead of one? I know that was kind of a lot, but hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, so a place that you want to go to see what I'm about to read to you, it's quoting from other documents, but is the Catechism of the Catholic Church, specifically paragraphs 1554 and 1555. In 1554, it says, so we have two models here. One is, I guess, three models based on the way you framed it. You could have three different sacraments of holy order, so a diaconal, a presbyterial, and an episcopal sacrament, or you could have one sacrament of holy orders that gets unlocked progressively. So like you get it once and you've got all the powers latent in you. But then when you're ordained a deacon, but then when you get ordained a priest, it like unlocks the powers that were already in you that are priestly. And when you get ordained a bishop, it unlocks the powers in you that were episcopal in nature. And then there's a third model, which is you receive one sacrament, but in stages. So like you get the diaconal grade of the sacrament first, and then the presbyterial grade second, and then the episcopal grade third. So bearing in mind these three models, let's look at what the Catechism has to say. In paragraph 1554, it says the divinely instituted ecclesiastical ministry is exercised in different degrees by those who even from ancient times have been called bishops, priests, and deacons. So you'll notice it's not talking in terms of three sacraments. It's talking in terms of three degrees of one sacrament. So that would tend to distance us from that first model where there's three separate versions of ordination as separate sacraments. So that's going to point us more towards the united view of this sacrament. It goes on to say, this is towards the end of the paragraph. Let me make sure I've got exactly the right point. Catholic doctrine teaches that the degrees, Catholic doctrine teaches that the degrees of priestly participation, episcopate and presbyterate, and the degree of service, diaconate, are all three conferred by a sacramental act called ordination, that is, by the sacrament of holy orders. So it envisions each degree being conferred by the administration of this sacrament. And so that would tend to eliminate the second view that I articulated, where you get all the powers at once and then they're progressively unlocked. Instead, it teaches that the degrees themselves are conferred by the sacramental act of ordination. And so that would put us in the third model, where you have one sacrament that is administered in three stages, and each stage confers new powers that were not there before. And this seems confirmed by paragraph 1555, which is talking about episcopal ordination, and it's quoting from the Second Vatican Council, and it says, amongst the various offices which have been exercised in the church from the earliest times, the chief place, according to the witness of tradition, is held by the function of those who, through their appointment to the dignity and responsibility of bishop, in virtue, consequently, of the unbroken succession going back to the beginning, are regarded as transmitters of the apostolic line. Actually, it's paragraph 1557 that says what I want. The Second Vatican Council teaches that the fullness of the sacrament of orders is conferred by episcopal consecration. So you don't have the fullness of the sacrament of holy orders until you get ordained bishop. That act of ordination to the episcopacy is what confers the fullness of the sacrament. And so that would tend to confirm the view that there's one sacrament administered in three degrees, and each degree confers new material. It doesn't just unlock stuff that was already there.
Randall, thanks for that question. Was that a helpful answer for you?
I see. Yes. Sorry, one quick follow-up. So just as I received the Eucharist, that sacrament, multiple times, or confession, does that mean like Pope Francis received the sacrament of holy orders three times too?
Yes, he did, in three different degrees. But you can only receive it once in each degree.
I see. Got it. Thank you so much. That clears up a lot.
Thank you, Randall, for that call. Yeah, thanks for that call, Randall. That clears up a line for us. 888-318-7884 is the number to call if you want to get through to Jimmy Akin today on this Ask Me Anything show. And we will now move along to Tom calling from San Antonio, Texas on Guadalupe Radio Network. Tom, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, hi. I was calling because Matthew 7, verse 13 and 14, the narrow gate. When I read it, I get motivated. Like, yeah, be one of the few. Don't follow the crowd. But several close people that I've talked to and family read it as like a sad verse. Like, oh, it's sad that so many people are on the road to hell. And I guess I was just curious if I'm interpreting it wrong.
Well, no. I think the reason, I mean, Jesus not only says this, he gives an imperative in conjunction with it, you know, seek the narrow way. He's telling you to do something. So that tells us that he means it to be a motivational passage. Be one of the ones who finds the way to life. So I don't think you're reading it wrong. On the other hand, I don't think that your friends or relatives are reading it wrong either, because it does contain an element of sadness. So I think it's a matter of subjective choice what an individual takes out of it at a given moment. At some moments, it can be taken as a motivator, as it should be, but at other moments, it could be taken as something reflecting a sad state of affairs where not everybody finds the way to life. So I think you're both correct.
Thanks for that question, Tom. And As I said, that opens up another line once again. So the number to call is 888-318-7884 if you want to get your question through to Jimmy Akin. And I want to tell you again about this Sacred Art for the Modern Age 2025 calendar that we have available right now at Catholic.com. Once again, the image on the front of the calendar of Christ the King was submitted.
It is a spoiler.
Yes, it is a spoiler for the month of November. But what a spoiler it is. I mean, take a look at that if you're watching on the live stream. It is submitted by Gwyneth Thompson Briggs, who, as I said, submitted this art. And she is dedicated to reviving techniques from the Renaissance and Baroque eras to reveal the glory of God. She holds advanced degrees in physics and engineering, along with a BFA from the Rocky Mountain College of Art and Design. So if you ever wanted a calendar containing sacred art that's by contemporary artists, one of whom is also apparently a physicist and engineer. I mean, we've got like maybe the only calendar in existence for you right here. So as I said, go to Catholic.com, click on the big bright orange banner right at the top, like impossible to miss, that says get your 2025 calendar now. Limited copies are available. So we're going to keep pushing it, but we want these to sell out because we want everyone to have this beautiful sacred art to beatify their homes all year long in 2025. And we will be back with more of Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin here on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is Way of the Fathers. It's a podcast about the fathers and doctors of the Church, the foundational figures of Christian history, hosted by Dr. Jim Papandrea. You can hear this and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Catholic Answers Live, Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin is the show today. If you want to call in, the number is 888-318-7884. Thomas Graff, the social media manager here at Catholic Answers, filling in for Cy Kellett once again. He'll be back with you on Monday, but meanwhile, we're going to keep plowing through these questions that we are getting from our eager callers. We're next going to go to Francis, calling from Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's watching on YouTube. Francis, go ahead with your question.
Hello, Mr. Akin.
Howdy, Francis.
I like your show.
Thank you.
I hope you're doing well.
I am.
My question is that if you're going to do an episode on Our Lady of Champion.
Well, it's funny you mention that. Now, for folks who may not be aware, Our Lady of Champion was a reported apparition of the Virgin Mary in the year 1859 in Wisconsin. And it is the only currently approved apparition in the United States. There are others here in North America, like Our Lady of Guadalupe, but this is the only one in the United States. And last night I was given a talk on apparitions at my parish, and I happened to mention Our Lady of Champion. So it's been fresh on my mind, and I may well do an episode of Mysterious World on this apparition at some point. I looked into it a few years ago when it got approved. I'd need to do more research to do an episode of Mysterious World on it, but I'm not opposed to doing that. I periodically do episodes on various reported apparitions, especially approved ones. And so yeah, I may well do that. In fact, I'll make sure that it's on my list.
Nice, Francis.
Yeah, I was just wondering because you have a lot of Marian apparitions on your show.
Yeah, indeed. And I've just added it to the spreadsheet. So I've got Our Lady of Champion on there now. And, of course, I don't know when I'll get to it because there are over 2,000 upcoming topics on the spreadsheet. But it's one of them now. So thank you for the suggestion.
Wow, Francis, you are now like a 1/2,000th co-producer on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World because you added a topic to his massive document list. So congratulations on that. That's a real accomplishment to add something to the list that 2,000 items. That's mind-boggling that that someone could think of something that wasn't on there. So well done, Francis. Well done. Let's go now to Eric, who is calling right in our backyard in San Diego, California, and he is watching on Twitch. Eric, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, yes. I was just curious about Jimmy's understanding of the mystic Luisa Picaretta. I was reading some of her things, and it's hard to get a piece of it because people compile different writings of hers, but I saw in one of them that it said she is the highest saint short of Mary herself, which I thought was a bold statement by a mystic.
Yep. So I looked into Luisa Picaretta a number of years ago, and based on the literature that was available at the time, I thought there are a bunch of danger signals here. Now, supporters of Luisa Picaretta will come back with, well, her bishop has a cause for canonization open. She's like a servant of God. And that's true. But the diocese has also noted that there are potential problems with her write-ins, especially the way they get translated. Apparently, they're written in a somewhat obscure dialect of Italian, and even the Italian speakers in the diocese had trouble processing some of them because of the dialect they're written in. And there was, at least I remember reading, that there was a prohibition on disseminating the existing translations of her writings. They were going to try to prepare a you know, critical edition that was properly translated, and that could be released. But my memory is that the diocese said, do not distribute translations of the write-ins that are currently available. So it may be that when they get that, that critical edition done, it may clear up some of the problems, but she did make some extraordinary claims. Like, you know, you mentioned some of her followers have claimed she's the greatest saint besides Mary. Others have said that the reference in the Our Father to thy will be done is like a special prophetic thing that has been hidden for 2,000 years that then Luisa Picaretta revealed. And any kinds of claims along those lines now are to me, they're red flags. They make this an atypical apparition. And a standard rule in parapsychological investigations or paranormal investigations, whether they're in the religious realm, so this would be applied by, you know, theologians and so forth, or whether they're, you know, outside the religious realm, is whenever you're looking at an atypical case, something that is not like the other cases, you need to be extra careful because atypical cases are frequently mistaken. That's, you know, that's why if it were typical, it would be more acceptable because we have other things saying the same stuff. But when you have really atypical claims being made, it's reason for extra caution. Also, I would point out that, and this is actually stated in the recent norms for evaluating supernatural phenomena that the DDF issued in May, that even when they give a nihil obstat to a nothing obstructs ruling to a saint's write-ins as part of a saint canonization process, it does not mean that those that any reported apparitions are authentic. So, you know, even if they were to grant a nihil obstat to the critical edition of her writings that they've been working on, it wouldn't mean that these are genuine supernatural revelations. So I have, until all this, you know, shakes out and we have better translations that can be relied upon. I have a cautious and somewhat distant attitude towards Luisa Picaretta. And I wouldn't be basing, you know, firm beliefs on what's currently out there in the literature because of its acknowledged deficiencies.
Thanks so much for that question, Eric. Jimmy, do you think that might be another future Mysterious World topic if the church ever does come out with a ruling on that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I just added another topic. All right. And our next call comes from Chandler in Rhonda, North Carolina, listening on YouTube. Chandler, go ahead. You are on the air with Jimmy Akin.
Hey, Jimmy. I'll try to keep my question short. Mm-hmm. My generation has a stereotype for not taking personal responsibility and perceiving mm-hmm. a lot of things as happening to us rather than things that are our fault. So my question mm-hmm. is, how do we strike the happy balance between taking personal responsibility versus, no, sometimes things genuinely do just happen to people? That's mm-hmm. my question. Thank you.
Well, you know, I'll do my best to answer this, but there's not a kind of a single cut and dried answer. I think when bad things happen and you're trying to assess why did the bad thing happen, one needs to look at the situation with realism. And so part of that involves looking at oneself. If you don't look at oneself, if you just assume that it's not your fault, which is a natural fallen human tendency, then you're not taking a realistic approach, because the fact is that humans are sinners and they do make mistakes. And so even though it can be uncomfortable to say, to what degree did I contribute to this, it's important to look at that question. And so that's part of finding the balance. Part of finding the balance is saying, what did I do? And could I have reasonably foreseen my actions lead into this outcome? And if I could reasonably have foreseen that this would happen based on my actions, then I need to accept responsibility for that. On the other hand, if I could not have reasonably foreseen it, then I'm not responsible in the same way. You know, if you just are going to the supermarket and you're driving your car and all of a sudden a tiny child races out in front of you and you hit the child because you have no time to stop, well, a bad thing happened, but you're not really responsible for it because you couldn't predict that, you know, you couldn't reasonably foresee what was going to happen from you just driving to the store. On the other hand, if you're driving through a school zone when kids are going to or coming through from school and you're racing down the street super fast, well, then you reasonably could foresee the danger and you would need to take more responsibility for it. So that's kind of half of the equation, looking at one's own actions, saying, could I reasonably foresee or have reasonably foreseen what would happen based on what I did? To what degree do I share responsibility here? On the other hand, you also need to consider other causes besides just yourself, because some people can focus on themselves as if they brought all the evils of the world on themselves and it's all their fault. And, you know, this is kind of a psychological disorder, but it is one that some people have where they assume excess responsibility and they think that they're more responsible for things than otherwise. For example, this story may be apocryphal, but I know it's out there. Martin Luther King Jr., for example, felt that his sins led to his mom either having a health problem or dying or something like that. And he reportedly threw himself out a window as a child. Well, okay, that was bad reasoning on his part. If that happened, he was assuming too much responsibility. His sins as a child did not lead to his mother having this bad thing happen to her. And so one needs to realistically both look at what one did and could have foreseen, but one also needs to look at part of looking at at the situation realistically is also looking at other causes and not overestimating yourself as a cause. So it's really a matter of balance, but those are some of the principles that I would bring to bear, both looking at yourself, looking at other factors, and saying realistically, to what degree did I and other factors play a role in the causation of this? And to what degree did I and other people have the ability to reasonably foresee this outcome?
Thanks for that question, Chandler. Did you find that helpful? Chandler, are you still
there? Yes, I did. Yeah. You can go ahead and head on.
Okay, yeah. Thanks a lot for that question, Chandler. I can assure you, by the way, that is not a generational problem you laid out, speaking as a member of one of the younger generations. Yeah, plenty of us also have a
so
tendency.
You're deflecting your responsibility from your generation, Thomas?
Oh no, I'm taking
you're
it right on.
You're just doing it collectively. Okay,
I'm taking it right on. We there are plenty of members of our generation, myself included, that want to ascribe more of our problems to external causes than just looking inward. I think that's just a human problem.
It's something that affects every generation. It's just a question of how much.
It certainly does. Yeah. In any case, we will be back with more Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. The number to call if you want your question asked is 888-318-7884. Don't go anywhere. We will be right back.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whyweearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The groovy music means we're halfway through the hour with Jimmy Akin. On this Ask Me Anything show, Jimmy Akin, of course, is our senior apologist, author, speaker, host and proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the Jimmy Akin podcast, The Mysteries of the Faith, all of those available wherever you listen to podcasts, including YouTube, catholic.com for the latter. And we're going next to Scott in Maryland. And Scott, you are on the air with Jimmy Akin. Go ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks, Jimmy, and thanks, Thomas, for not being a cyborg like Sai.
As far as you know, right? Yeah, no, I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm definitely not a cyborg like Sai.
I always had a feeling about him. All right, Jimmy, my question is, does the Catholic Church have an interpretation on Exodus 4:24? And if they don't, do you have one?
Okay, so Exodus 4:24 is a passage that says, this is talking about Moses after he's fled Midian and he's on his way back to Egypt. God has summoned him at the burning bush in Exodus 3 to go back to Egypt and lead his people. And so he's on his way back, and it says, at a lodging place on the way, the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. The Catholic Church has no interpretation, no official interpretation of this verse. It has no interpretation, no official interpretation for almost every verse in the Bible. It generally leaves it to scholars to try to figure out what different Bible verses mean, as long as they don't contradict a point of the faith, they have wide liberty in doing that. Now, of course, I just read the single verse. It's part of a longer story, though, which isn't that long, but it says it. So it says the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. One key question is who is the him here? You'd think it's Moses. But then we read, then Zipporah, that's Moses's wife, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses's feet with it and said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. It was then said that she said a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. So this is considered one of the most mysterious passages in the Old Testament because it is not really clear here why God is angry with Moses and trying to kill him. And it's not really clear who some of the hims are, because we've got three people in this passage that could be described as him: God, Moses, and Moses's son. And so you can read this passage several different ways. Also, the language about a bridegroom of blood is obscure and hard to translate into English and Hebrew. That's the standard translation, and there's some support for that, but it's not as clear as it could be. Also, bridegroom, that refers to like a man who's just gotten married, but Moses has been married to Zipporah for some time now. So it's a little odd if she's describing him as a bridegroom. Now, what can we say here with some confidence? I think that it's pretty clear that God is mad with Moses because he has failed to have his son circumcised. Because as far back as Genesis, when God gave the covenant of circumcision to Abraham, he made it clear this is supposed to apply to all of your descendants. And that includes Moses, and that includes Moses' son. So if Moses is now on his way back to Egypt to assume the leadership of the Israelites, and he hadn't even circumcised his own son, that's not a particularly good thing for a leader of the Israelites who are all supposed to be circumcised. So I think you could argue that what Moses should have done was made sure that his son was circumcised before he goes back and starts, the process of trying to become the leader of the Israelites. So I think that's kind of the best guess for why God is mad at him. Also, and this is a bit of a step down, but I don't think it's a big step down in terms of confidence level, is what it's referring to when Zipporah takes the foreskin and touches it to Moses' feet. Now, taking that literally, it would mean, she touched it to his feet. Why would she do that? Well, it's a little harder to say. Possibly a possibility is it provides some kind of identification of the circumcision with Moses, and thus it could be understood as a ritual action to deflect the wrath of God. On the other hand, I think there's likely more to it than that, because in Hebrew, regel, or feet, is a euphemism for the male member. And so I think, given that we're talking about circumcision here, I think that there is a pretty high degree of probability that Zipporah actually touches the foreskin to Moses's male member, thus strengthening the identification between Moses and this circumcision that should have been done earlier. There are additional things one can wonder about here, and a lot of scholars have wondered about them. If I were going to do a deep dive on this, you know, I just start looking up some commentaries and seeing what they have to say. In particular, one person I know who has talked about this is the, unfortunately, late, he just recently passed on, but the evangelical scholar Michael Heiser. H-E-I-S-E-R. And Mike, who I knew, is pretty good about digging into mysterious passages and trying to figure them out. So, and I know he's talked about this one. So I would, one of the sources I would check, I'd check others too, but one of the sources I'd check would be Michael Heiser. So I'd Google Michael Heiser, Bridegroom of Blood, and read what he has to say on the topic.
Scott, thank you so much for that question. I hope that was a helpful answer for you. My name is Thomas Graff. I'm filling in for Cy Kellett tonight on Catholic Answers Live, and our next caller comes from Long Island, New York, where Rich is listening on the EWTN app. Rich, go ahead. You are on the air. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, Jimmy, before my question, I just wanted to give you a thanks. You did a podcast on synesthesia, on Mysterious World. And I have it. And it was one of the first times I've ever heard someone talk about it. So it hit home with me. I always thought I was crazy growing up as a kid seeing colors when I heard sound, and you pretty much nailed it.
Okay, cool. As I talk about in that episode, I have several forms of synesthesia too. That is not one of mine. That's sometimes called chromesthesia. I have a kind of weak form of chromesthesia, but it's not as strong as some people's. So glad that was helpful.
Yeah, very good. So thank you. My question's probably a bit on the trivial side, but I do my best to make my donations to all the various, you know, churches, monasteries, you guys, Catholic Answers, and so forth. And consequently, though, I get inundated with tons and tons of religious literature stuff, Magnificats, calendars, mass cards, and so forth. My question is, what is the, I can't give it all away or leave it in a church lobby. Some of the stuff has my name on it. What is the best way to dispose of it? Like, I don't want to throw out an envelope with Divine Mercy or something on it. I feel like it's disrespectful, but I've got boxes and boxes in my office of all this stuff. It builds up. So just wanted to know, what is the best way to respectfully deal with it?
Okay, so before I answer that question, I'll mention something you can do. If there are particular organizations that are sending you literature as like a thank you and you don't want it, just tell the organization, you know, say, I here's my donation, but please don't send me any literature of whatever type they're sending you. You know, we do that at Catholic Answers. If someone says, here's a donation, but I don't want the premium associated with it, we respect their wish and we don't send them the premium. So so that's something you may be able to do to cut down on getting this in the future. In terms of how to dispose of what you got, well, okay, if it's got your name on it, you could always black that out with a magic marker really good, or rip it off and then donate it. That's a possibility. But fundamentally, there is, and this is not church law, so what I'm about to say is a matter of custom rather than a matter of law. The standard division as a matter of custom is between things that are blessed and things that are not blessed. If something is not blessed, you treat it as if it were an ordinary object. And so if you've got an ordinary object that you can't reasonably give away and that you don't want anymore, throw it in the trash and do not worry about it beyond that. It doesn't matter what it's got on it. It's an ordinary object in terms of traditional Catholic custom. On the other hand, and so it to attribute greater significance to it than an ordinary object where you're hoarding this stuff and it's building up in your house, that's a form of scrupulosity. And so do not be scrupulous about this. On the other hand, suppose it's blessed. What do you do then? Well, again, this is a matter of custom, not a matter of law. But the custom is if you can either burn it or bury it. And since we're talking literature, it's flammable. You know, unless someone's sending you stone tablets in the mail. So you should be able to burn it. You could have a fire in your fireplace. If you got a fireplace, you could, if you got a fire pit, you could do it there. You could put it in a bag and take it down to the city incinerator. There's any number of things you could do, but the traditional customary way of disposing of flammable blessed items is to burn them as a sign of respect rather than just throwing them away.
Got it. Great. Thank you.
Thank you
no
for that.
Problem.
Yep. Thank you for that call, Rich. That was a very, that was, I'm sure that was helpful for most people because I'm sure many of our listeners and Rich himself, we do receive that stuff in the mail all the time. And if anyone's curious actually about a little bit more on why that's the custom, we do have an article on Catholic.com titled Giving Sacramentals a Proper Farewell by our good friend Sean McAfee. He goes into a little bit why the custom is to bury those objects or burn them. And that article is actually taken, adapted from a whole booklet, a 20 Answers booklet that McAfee wrote for us called 20 Answers, Relics, and Sacramentals, which is available right now and all weekend long for only $2 on shop.catholic.com, along with every other 20 Answers booklet that we have on that shop. Only $2 for those 20 Answers booklets, $10 for our more of our full-length books, many of our bestsellers and new books are all available on shop.catholic.com for $10. And nearly everything in our online shop, in fact, is reduced 10 to 25% and more. Books, online courses, ebooks, MP3s, rosaries, scapulars, merchandise, tons of stuff. We're bringing Black Friday out early this weekend only. So if you want to take advantage of some of those amazing deals, visit shop.catholic.com this weekend, November 15th through 18th. And all that can be yours at great, great Black Friday rates. We will be right back with our final segment of Catholic Answers Live right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
He is honored by the Church as a saint and theologian with the title of Universal Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Albert the Great was a Dominican, theologian, scientist, and teacher of whom it was said that he knew the sum total of human knowledge in his time. He also helped shape the even more brilliant St. Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor. Albert died in 1280 and was named a Doctor of the Church in 1931.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, taking you home all the way on a Friday evening in this final segment of Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, we are going to maybe go a little lightning mode on these last few questions to try to get through as many callers as we can. So next we're going to go to Damien calling from Austin, Texas, listening on Twitch. Damien, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. My question or observation seems to be with the moral structure of the Catholic teaching is that you guys remove consent and stewardship from your moral theology.
Really? Why do you say that?
Yes. Well, to a couple of other hosts, when I call into this, they give different responses. So it seems to be more of their personal interpretation instead of church doctrine, is that from person to person, there's stewardship and accountability because that other person can hold you accountable. But when they're talking about the relationship between the individual to God, God is no longer being morally assessed because you define it as definitionally perfect, perfectly good by definition. which removes any honest moral assessment of its next actions that it does in the relationship to you, for you to actually see if it's being right, doing right by you or not. So that
okay, Damien, hang on just a second. We're in a part of the show where we unfortunately don't have as much time to explore matters in depth, and I'd have to say you're talking on a very abstract level. I'm not sure what you're referring to. Can you give me concrete examples, at least one of each, of where you perceive Catholics as removing consent from their moral theology? And can you also give me one example of where you see Catholics removing stewardship from moral philosophy? And as part of that, please let me know what kind of consent you're referring to. Consent to what? And then also what type of stewardship you're referring to. What resources are being stewarded?
Sure. So in the stewardship, Trent Horn states that God, because God creates human beings, he can murder us, and it's not an immoral thing to do. So that removes stewardship because we are his playthings to play with as he wants, and there's no moral assessment of that whatsoever because he owns us as property.
Okay, I would pretty sure Trent didn't use the word murder. He might have used kill, but okay, go ahead. What's an example of lack of consent?
Well, if you take my life without my consent, you're murdering me.
That's not the case, but okay.
That is the case, sir.
No, there are other situations in which a person can take a life without consent, and it's not murder. A famous example is with the trolley problem, where if you have, a train coming down the tracks, it's either going to hit five people or it's going to divert onto a secondary track and hit one person. You're in control of the switch of which track does it go down. And most people in that situation would say, throw the switch so that it goes down the track that only kills one person instead of killing five people. In that situation, the switch operator is in a horrible position because someone's life is going to be taken. But it seems rational to most people to throw the switch so that only one person dies. Now, presumably that one person who dies has not given his consent to dying, but it nevertheless is deemed a rational thing and thus not murder. Murder is not simply killing without consent. It's unjust killing, whether the consent is given or not. You can murder someone who consents and it's still murder. The issue is it a just killing or not? As opposed to a consensual killing or not. So if that's the kind of consent that you're thinking about, if it's just in this specific problem about God taking life, I would say that that it's actually not relevant to the issue of murder here. But that doesn't result in a broader denial of consent, because actually consent is something that Catholic moral theology incorporates and uses all the time. You know, I mean, just to give one example, matrimonial consent, the consent to be married, is a necessary prerequisite to be able to have matrimonial relations with someone. If you don't have someone's matrimonial consent, then what you're doing with them is either adultery or fornication. So that's just one example where consent is necessary. In terms of stewardship, I don't know that I would frame the issue of stewardship is also a prominent theme in Catholic moral theology. For example, again, to cite just one example, it is universally acknowledged that God has given the stewardship of the earth into mankind's care, and mankind is therefore responsible for properly stewarding the resources here on earth for the benefit not just of himself, but more broadly than that. And similarly, there's an acknowledgement that with our own personal financial resources, we have to steward those properly. It sounds like, based on the single example you gave, that you're more concerned not with the issues of stewardship and consent being eliminated from Catholic moral theology in general, but how you perceive them being applied to God in his relations with human beings. And so God does have stewardship of human beings, but God also has rights that human beings don't have. Specifically, he gives us everything we've got. And so it's up to God to determine how much of particular gifts we have, like the gift of life. And that can be longer for some than it is for others. But that doesn't mean that it would be just for God to capriciously and mercilessly play with us and our deaths. I mean, he's not like Q from Star Trek The Next Generation, who just plays with human life for his own fun. God doesn't do that. So, you know, I don't know what Trent said that you're responding to, but I'm pretty sure he didn't want to portray God as some capricious, super powerful being that gets delight at tormenting humans and ending their lives capriciously. God is loving. He loves us. He doesn't do that. So, so there is a dimension of stewardship to how God interacts with us, and he preserves our lives and he cares for us. He's not going to make us immortal in our present state, but he does love us and care for us and preserve our lives. And, you know, as Jesus said, you know, he knows when a sparrow falls from the sky, and he cares about us much more than he cares about sparrows. So I think you may be taking a somewhat jaundiced approach to some of the things you've heard. I always recommend taking as sympathetic approach to everybody as possible and think through it in their terms. You know, what are they trying to say here? What's the most charitable reading I can give to this? Are there ways that I can see where what I'm hearing could be true, even if it's not how I would express it? So I would encourage you, in listening to some of these discussions, to try to think it through from the point of view of the person who you're listening to, and look for good in that and see how much good you can find. And then anything that remains is something that's subject for legitimate criticism.
Damien, thanks so much for that question. Sorry we couldn't dive into that a little more, but we are reaching the end of the show. Let's go to Mark, calling from Portland, Oregon, listening on Modern Day Radio. Mark, we are near the end of the hour, so if you could ask your question very quickly and succinctly, that would be great.
Okay, it pertains to, thanks for taking my call, by the way. We have a great pastor in our church, has the youth extremely involved. Since COVID, we don't any longer pass the basket at the offertory, no monetary gifts are taken up. There are boxes in the back of church and card readers for electronic donations. So I feel like I'm just older. I feel like we're missing an opportunity because we have a tremendous amount of youth and a lot of young families in the parish to, you know, physically have the children involved and see the example of giving a donation during the service. So I did a little research, tried to come up with things, including your book, Mass Confusion. Couldn't really come up with anything.
Mark, just so you know, we are getting right down to the end of the show. Is there a question you'd like to ask me?
Sure. What's your suggestion on how to respect? I mean, is it appropriate to try to approach the pastor respectfully and look for, you know, is there like research that I could do or any like?
Okay, so I'm Mark, I need a chance to respond. If your question is, how can you talk to your pastor about restoring, passing the basket for offerings, it's not disrespectful to ask him. The canon law protects the right of the faithful to advise the pastors of the church, including your own parish pastor, of what you think would be good for the church, as long as you do it respectfully. So you could go to him and say, hey, Father, here's what I think we should do. I think we should bring this back. And you know, here are my reasons why. I think it would set a good example for younger people and things like that. Now, he might come back and say, well, I don't want to do that because germs. Well, okay, maybe, but there are other things you can pass besides a collection basket. I've seen some churches that have like the basket on a long pole, even retractable poles, and they don't actually pass it. They just have the collection takers go around and hold the pole with the bag in front of people. So that's a possibility. But he may come back and say, well, actually, we're getting all the money we need right now. In which case, you know, and he may say, actually, the young people are seeing their parents make that donation with the card readers. And so that's how they're getting an example. He may or may not agree with what you have to say, but as long as you're polite and calm and, you know, state your case, it's absolutely fine to do that.
Thanks for that question, Mark. Thank you to all of our callers today on 2 hours of Catholic Answers Live. That's all the time we have. Sorry to the callers that we couldn't get to, but call in again any day you like. And we will be happy to answer your question. Jimmy Yankin, thank you so much for 2 great hours of Ask Me Anything.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for sticking with me today as I filled in for Cy Kellett. As I said, he will be back in after the weekend on Monday. And until then, we will see you right back here, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.